The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Hugh Muir. And he's off. Labour's king over the water heads over the water. So does David Miliband's departure finally mean the end for New Labour? And what about the digital Benites? Is the party now under siege from the left? Back to the future, as food stamps are introduced instead of emergency loans. At the same time, ministers deny that benefit staff were set targets to sanction claimants. And what about Boris? Is he a nasty piece of work? It was Boris Johnson week on the BBC. Was that the end of him, or just the beginning?
Well, I think all three things I would dispute.
A full order paper then. This is Politics Weekly. And joining me for all of this is The Observer's political editor Toby Helm, New Statesman political editor Raphael Baer, and political journalist and Boris Johnson's biographer Andrew Jimson. All good fellows, not a nasty piece of work amongst them. Welcome to you all.
I feared I didn't want to become a distraction from that central task. I didn't want the soap opera to take over the real substance of what needs to be done. So has it been hard for me to accept that I can best help the Labour Party by giving not just the space between the front bench and the back bench to Ed, but the space between the front bench and 3,000 miles away? Yes, that's hard for me, but I think it's right.
So the psychodrama is over. 2 years after being defeated by his brother in that epic battle for the Labour leadership, David Miliband resigns his seat and exits British politics. He's off to New York to run the charity International Rescue. It's a move that for many formally signals the end of New Labour and the dominance of the Blairite wing that's held sway since the early 1990s. Raphael, David's been practically anonymous in Parliament and refused the offer of a front bench job. Was it inevitable that it would end this way?
I think it probably was for a couple of reasons. First, as you say, he didn't want to join the shadow cabinet. The offer was sort of there formally. I think the offer had to be made in public at some level to demonstrate the will for reconciliation. Ultimately, there was a big question as to what on earth David would do. There's only one job he really wanted in the Labour Party, and that was leader. Not a vacancy for that. People talked about him as possible shadow chancellor. Well, Ed Balls is doing that, and so that there's complications there. When you really drill into it, what was the big problem? The big problem is that David and a lot of the people who supported him didn't really accept that Ed won. I mean, Ed obviously won. He's leader of the Labour Party. But the way in which it happened, the way it was sort of engineered for him by using the union vote in the electoral college and the rest of it, gave the David people a sense that somehow his entitlement had been taken from him. And he was never really reconciled to that. So unless you were going to get a great big romantic brotherly sort of reunion, which would have been the happy ending to the story, then the alternative was for him to just get out. And the former wasn't going to happen, and the latter has.
Toby, Ed made all the right noises afterwards, talked about this being a great loss to the party and a great loss to British politics. But will he be pleased in a way that the distraction that was his brother is no longer there?
I think he may well be pleased, yeah. I think what was striking, seeing David Miliband talking about his decision yesterday, was he really looked like somebody who believed what he was saying when he said he wanted to get himself out of British politics and remove himself from the soap opera. And Ed must have felt that too, because every time David came into the House of Commons or came into Portcullis House or was around Westminster and he spotted somebody like me or another journalist, he knew that the question to him would be, are you coming back? And he knew the interpretation of it would be all around, you know, what's it going to mean for you and Ed? He could not get on with his life in a normal way without it being seen through that prism. So I think Ed will be relieved for himself and he'll be relieved for David. And I think it is a way of actually healing this whole thing. And I don't think David Miliband will come back. I think he'll be quite seduced by the life in America. And I think it is actually a means of the family getting back together, actually, by going apart.
Peter Anderson said, you know, don't write him off. He could always come back. But you don't buy that?
Don't think it's impossible, but I think it's highly unlikely. I mean, I think David Miliband came down from a huge height, you know, when he lost that leadership election. I think people forget that he was actually foreign secretary before that. So he went from foreign secretary to losing a leadership election to being nobody. And I think, you know, that's done. It's all the rift is too big, the damage is too big, and I think the attraction of America will be too great.
Andrew, what are the Tories thinking? Would they have feared David?
What I think is that he made his original blunder was in 2007. He should have stood against Gordon Brown. He'd have lost, but there wouldn't have been a coronation. There'd have been a fight, and that would have established David Miliband as the preeminent challenger. And he didn't quite do that. He didn't have the risk-taking mentality that is sometimes needed at the highest level in politics. I think the Tories, on the whole, reckon that there's no one who would have made a perfect leader of the opposition. He would have looked more prime ministerial. So he would have been a more dangerous sort of, you know, leader-in-waiting sort of figure, although quite capable of making himself look ridiculous with bananas and things as well. So I think the Tories will feel that the Labour is a bit weakened by this. I think the key thing for Labour is whether they can draw on people like Alistair Darling, who really could make most of the Tories look extremely callow.
And what will the Tories think if there is a significance to this, if him going really does mean the end of that New Labour era? Because they would have feared New Labour, perhaps, more than they would have feared Ed Miliband's version of it.
They're still hoping that Ed Miliband will sort of veer back into some brown-eyed cul-de-sac. I don't think Ed Miliband will gratify them by doing that.
Ralph, let's talk about Labour. They've had a tumultuous week in some ways. There was that decision to abstain on an important vote about welfare. Ed Miliband, I think, himself pressured MPs to abstain on the recent Job Seekers Bill, which was rushed through Parliament, as a way of avoiding embarrassing payouts to people in the workfare scheme. Unite, the union, is furious, and of course it stumps up a lot of money. Will all this be quite significant in the long run?
Oh, it's significant because it's a sign of turbulence to come. I mean, actually, the Labour got lucky because the budget was happening and there were other big stories, and it meant that not a lot of people noticed that, you know, 43 MPs rebelled and a PPS. No, they don't have PPSs if they're in opposition. But yes, a
shadow bag carrier
stood down. The argument that Liam Byrne, the shadow work and pension secretary, supported by the whole of the shadow cabinet, Ed Miliband and both Eds were behind the scenes sort of pushing for this. The argument that they bring is that what the legal ruling that they were trying, that the government wanted to sort of strike down, had done, had essentially undermined the basic capability of the work of the DWP to administer sanctions when people are claiming benefits and not actively seeking work. And that capability, the basic point of sanctions, is now embedded as a fundamental part of pretty much all welfare policy. If Labour gets into government, there will be sanctions in what they do in welfare. That's just a cast iron fact. And so what the sort of Labour front bench was sort of saying was, we have to recognise that. We can't pretend that's not an issue, but if we abstain, we can get some practical concessions. So it was a sort of technocratic response to the problem. Now, of course, there are lots and lots of people in the Labour Party who think, frankly, sod your New Labour centrist technocracy. You know, we've got a row of Molotov cocktails here, which we want to throw at the government. We want to be a party of angry protest against the cuts and what we see as the government vilifying, you know, being vindictive towards the unemployed. And you're not letting us do it. And that anger suddenly erupted in this moment. And there will be a whole lot more of that in the next couple of years.
Toby, I suppose what gave this traction is that it wasn't just grassroots activists who seemed to be aggrieved at the party's strategy of abstaining. It was MPs as well. I'm told there was a pretty fiery meeting of the PLP, and we know from the MPs that we were talking to that a lot of people were very unhappy.
Yeah, I mean, the Labour Party's still divided. There's a old left, there's a left, there's a moderate, and there's a centre-right. Liam Byrne, who's driving the welfare policy, is very much on the centre-right. He's almost off the right edge of the party. And the people who were rebelling are on the left or the hard left. So the party's held together pretty well under Ed Miliband, but there still are factions. And as Raf said, I mean, the key thing here is that on welfare, as on immigration, Labour has to be, it still is aware that it needs to be fairly New Labour on these things. And Liam Byrne talks a lot. They haven't come up with policy yet, but he talks a lot about building conditionality into benefits. Yeah. And you'll see a lot more of this as they come close to the election. I wouldn't be surprised if Labour's policy on welfare and what you need to do to get your benefits is as tough as the Tories when it comes to the election, if not in some ways a bit tougher. And in that way, they'll show that they're not just the party of the unions. They'll show that they're not just the party of Red Ed.
It's also just a butt in there for a second. The in marginal seats on, I mean, Labour ahead in the opinion polls at the headline level, marginal seats, Labour is 16 points behind on the specific issue of welfare. And when you ask people what are the most salient issues, the things that will really decide how you vote, the top three are the economy, immigration and welfare. So the Labour leadership, they've been in the focus groups, they've looked at the polls, they know they have to sound a little bit more like the Tories on this stuff. That's just sophology.
And the old point about, you know, an argument which you can win fairly easily with the left is pretty good for Ed Miliband, it can be argued.
Yes, the left is surely pretty weak, isn't it? Because this expression digital Benites has been used, but there isn't a Ben. Or in fact, there is a Ben, but he's Hillary Ben, and he's completely decent, moderate, almost invisible, admittedly. But there is no sort of Tony Benn figure.
He's got to be a bit, Miliband's got to be a bit careful with the unions who did get him to where he is. But at this stage of the parliament, there's always a bit of kind of theatrical argument between the unions whose leaders are generally fighting to be re-elected as general secretary, and then when it comes to the election they cough up the money and they all go quiet.
I'd be a little bit more wary if I were on the Labour front bench of this digital Bennism, actually, as they call it, because I just think it's something that the Tories have discovered in government, that actually the nature of campaigning politics has changed. And the great example of this was the forestry sell-off. The reason that unravelled horribly for the government early on was actually a very well-organised, very well-mobilised campaign of people firing off emails, campaigning online, and MPs, or gay marriage is another example actually, MPs suddenly realising that their BlackBerries are full of sort of 5,000 emails from people in their constituencies telling them, you're a bastard and I'm not going to vote for you. And actually, at some point, that has an impact. And Labour, because they haven't been in power, haven't had to make these difficult decisions, hasn't yet experienced the force of that, but they will, and it will make MPs consider who to whom they are more loyal.
Andrew, if you're Ian Duncan Smith and you're piloting through what's a very contentious piece of policy, is it helpful to you to look across the benches and find that Labour, the opposition, is no more united on this than your own party?
Well, obviously there are big there's a big temptation for the Tories to play this very politically, because they know that a lot of Labour voters, respectable members of the working class, are really furious who people can live, apparently live sort of lives of total fecklessness and take advantage of a system which actually was set up as an insurance for when you're in genuine need, which almost everyone would support. So, but I think Duncan Smith himself doesn't want to play it that way. Linton Crosby is probably, thinks is one of the few bright spots in an otherwise dark picture.
That's an Australian strategist who you think would play on the division, would exploit the divisions as much as he can.
Yeah.
So we've seen this week the introduction of controversial food stamps in lieu of emergency loans to benefit claimants. What do we think? Is this the thin end of a nasty wedge, or just a reasonable way of keeping welfare claimants out of betting shops and off licences, to take a coruscating view of it?
I'd take the former interpretation of that. I mean, having said everything I said about the political necessity of being, in quotes, tough on benefits that where people with conditionality and the rest of it, the whole welfare state is predicated on the fact that you give people money. What they do with it is ultimately has to be a matter for their individual judgment. You don't tell middle class people getting child benefit or pensioners getting winter fuel allowance that actually, you know, you have to spend the money specifically in this way. So it's hard to see it not as something that sort of denigrates people at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. And going back to what Andrew said, I think that is because, I mean, having had conversations with people involved in the Conservative strategy, and I've put to them this point that, you know, aren't you in danger of coming across as just basically a bit nasty and mean? What they say back to you is, you would struggle to meet public opinion on how mean and nasty you can be on this stuff. Trust us, we are not, you know, we are the soft, namby-pamby, bleeding-heart liberals on this issue compared to where public opinion is. So, you know, that tells you a lot about where they think they can go with this stuff.
That's really interesting, Toby. Isn't food stamps a lethal phrase that no government would want attached to it?
It looks like that, but I tend to agree with Raf on that. I think that the Conservative Party has done its focus groups. It's assessed the issue of welfare as the one where it can just go as far as it wants. And although it is a lethal phrase, and although it looks, well, it looks every bit as bad as you describe it, I think that they see it as a policy worth pursuing, a kind of tone worth pursuing for the simple benefits that it will bring. But I think it shows a certain ruthlessness. And I'm not 100% sure that in 18 months' time that sort of approach from the Tory party will actually work as well as we think. I think there may be a bit of a change as people get more and more desperate.
Andrew, do you think they will recognise that there are dangers to this? If they have a great deal of licence from the public to get tough on welfare, might that take them over the top? Might that mean that they get too tough and become the nasty party?
Well, there are big dangers of the whole thing simply not working. One hears sort of rumours that the computers aren't going to work. I haven't the faintest idea whether they are. I think they've had to sort of
It's usually a fairly safe assumption.
Although computers are getting easier to work. Given that everyone, including people like myself who don't hate using computers, is going to have to use a computer to get at this stuff, the system design will have to be extraordinarily user-friendly, and I question whether they're going to manage that.
We give you our Luddite of the Week award. A tumultuous week within Whitehall as well. Today, a mini reshuffle at the Department of Energy and Climate Change. John Hayes is out, Michael Fallon is in. Toby, we're told of a personality clash and dysfunctionality within the department. But
well, it
happens all the time, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does happen all the time. But I mean, the history, recent history of the Department of Energy and Climate Change is mind-boggling, actually. I mean, this is a government that came in claiming to be the greenest government ever. We heard nauseating amounts of promotion of David Cameron's green credentials. We used that ghastly phrase
Fetch
before the election.
The Huskies were howling at
us. We then had virtually nothing since the election. Cameron, I think, has made one speech mentioned green policy. The delightful and very good Charles Hendry, who was the energy minister until last summer, was kicked out for no apparent reason when he was doing an extremely good job. They bring in John Hayes, who is an extreme climate sceptic, who clearly is not sceptic enough. And for some reason, now he's booted out in favour of the even more sceptic Michael Fallon. God knows what's going on, but there is a kind of war at the heart of green policy, and it's just a total shambles.
Raph, do you think it's policy and not personality? Because people do say that Ed Davey and Hayes just could not get along. And did Davey not try and take some legal advice as to whether or not he could circumscribe John Hayes' decision-making powers?
They got off to a bad start, partly because it was briefed that Hayes had been told by Cameron, you get a win for our people on wind farms, when he went into the department. So essentially, and you know, in the background, you've also got the Chancellor, who it's pretty much an open secret that he thinks carbon targets are a sort of a horrible yoke on business, and ideally you wouldn't have them, and if he could scrap the Climate Act tomorrow he probably would, but he can't. So and this was in the run-up to the energy bill being published, and so that process became, as you say, so poisonous and toxic at a personal level inside the department and between the department and the Treasury that I think probably moving Hayes out is partly a way of releasing some of that toxins, of lancing that boil. I think also remember that the job he's going to do is to advise, be a parliamentary advisor to David Cameron. Hayes is someone who will have had the ear of a lot of people on the right of the party who have been plotting, who've been talking against Cameron. I would see him being recruited in that role as sort of, as we were talking about this earlier, sort of a defector coming into the embassy with a list of agents who he can now tell, you know, brief Cameron about. He knows where a lot of rebellious bodies are buried, or where a lot of, you know, priest holes behind the bookcases are.
Come on, hey, John Hayes, he believes in faith, family and flag, and that's what a lot of fairly boneheaded Tory backbenchers believe in, and they're the people who can do Cameron in. So it is an attempt to sort of plug himself into that bit of the party which he's generally treated with the disdain that its intellectual gifts deserve.
But I mean, this is the most important, this was described by Cameron as the most important issue facing our world, not
just
our nation.
Yeah, but the recession.
Before
the election. I know that, Andrew.
But we've swapped three times now our energy ministers for kind of pathetic reasons to do with sort of niggly, you know, personality difficulties and arguments. I mean, what does that say about the priorities that this government has?
On the whole, it's fairly unusual, though, in this government. Cameron, on the whole, has stuck with people. He hasn't had constant...
It is unusual, I agree. It is fairly unusual.
Yeah,
that's true.
Well, it's stuck with people. Well, what about the issue? Has he abandoned the issue?
He hasn't stuck with that. That's really true.
I'd hate to bring it back to sort of focus groups and polling again, but you have to remember also that green issues are just not salient to a lot of people. And worse, actually, and Labour people have said this to me, that depressingly, perhaps, when you ask people what they think about green issues, what they say to you is, well, this is a sort of a nasty middle-class affectation. Have you seen how much organic apples cost compared to normal food? And so what I'm sure part of the calculation will be in the sort of Cameron machine is actually us standing up and saying, yeah, we really believe in green stuff.
No,
makes us seem
that,
a bit posh
and
farmers
marketing. I agree with that, but overall it helps create an impression that Cameron, you know, says one thing, does another.
Absolutely.
The individual issue, yes, people don't give a stuff about it, and most people except the, you know, Greenpeace and The Guardian and The Observer. But
The Green Party isn't doing very well. You might have thought they would replace the Liberal Democrats, and they haven't.
Yes, but for Cameron to play it up and then just completely abandon it, that does stick in people's...
But magnificent flexibility, pragmatic statesmanship.
Andrew, what the interpretation of this on Conservative Home or from Tim Montgomery was that in John Hayes they now have someone, a Tory who doesn't really sound like a Tory, who can go and do all the interviews and maybe attract some people to vote Tory who might not have done so without that deployment. Do you think that theory holds any
water? He's worked his passage, hasn't he, from sort of about the age of 15. And was very, I think he was someone who got very angry when they had the A-list and sort of, you know, fashionable chick lit authors being wafted in who'd never done any canvassing or wouldn't even know how to sort of knock on a council house door.
Yeah, but Louise Mencher's gone now.
Yeah, she's gone. But so it is, again, it's, yeah.
But do they need that? Is that a problem
that
they have?
Well, I think actually we're back to the great Linton Crosby, the Australian master strategist, and he says you have to lock in your base first and then you go for the swing. But the first thing is to... And the base, frankly, a lot of them have gone off to UKIP, so or in danger of doing so. So you can see that they're shoring up the base, aren't they?
Yeah. We see him doing that.
Hayes could help a bit with that.
But do we think he'll forget to go for the swing? We can see him shoring up.
He's going to have to
base.
Yeah, I think
it's very hard to do both, isn't it? Because the reason the swing gets pushed away is because of this sort of cultural inoculation that a lot of people have against voting Conservative, precisely because of a lot of the things that the base wants to hear. So they are almost sort of mutually exclusive practices, which is one of the main reasons why it's very, very hard for the Conservatives to win a majority at the next election.
So what will they do next? You'll get some idea by looking at our website with that and all the other doings at Westminster. It's guardian.co.uk/politics. So how was Boris week for you? He was everywhere. The London Mayor was afforded a sympathetic hour-long documentary on primetime this week, but only after he'd been put through his paces, and that's understating the situation, by a terrier-like Eddie Mayer.
Making up quotes, lying to your party leader, wanting to be part of someone being physically assaulted. You're a nasty piece of work, aren't you?
Well, I think, Eddie, all three things I would dispute.
Well, you don't factually dispute them.
Well, I do, and I could, you know, if we had a long time, which we don't, I could explain that I think all three interpretations you're putting on those things aren't wholly fair.
Toby, what did you make of Boris week? Is it a hiccup for the blonde, or what? The week
well,
that
it looked,
his mask
certainly looked that way at the beginning, but my view was pretty quickly after that Eddie Mayer interview, which was a disaster, and Boris actually did look genuinely unprepared for it. Is that actually, will people really, you know, in a few weeks' time, hold all the stuff that was mentioned in that interview against him, or will they slightly think it makes Boris look a bit vulnerable? We can not only like him and think he's funny, but we can also feel a bit sorry for him as a human being, and da 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 da. I don't think that really damages Boris, and I think this is my colleagues here might disagree with me, but I think the week as a whole is pretty damn good for Boris. I think that documentary came across extremely well. There was a depth to Boris that we didn't know about before. There were complications in his family life that we didn't know about before. He was an interesting character. He came across as somebody who we'd like to know more about, not less about. And I think it's positive overall.
I'm going to hold back Andrew Jimson, the oracle, and come to him last. But Raf, did you learn anything that you didn't know before?
I actually broadly agree with Toby for two reasons. First, I think he's going to have to answer these questions, and actually it's quite useful to relatively early on do quite a tough interview on them, so that in the future when you're asked about them you can say, I've answered all the questions I need to answer about this.
But he didn't.
Move on. It doesn't matter. I say, you've asked me these questions, I refer you to my previous answer. You can then say, well, your previous answer,
we know about
answer.
The allegations.
I said I a lot, but I didn't answer anything.
So also the important thing to understand about Boris, I think, is that the entire proposition is that he doesn't play by the conventional rules and that he isn't a politician like any others. I think sensible people in the Labour Party are genuinely afraid of him because they say he actually connects with people who don't really care about politics in a way like no one else since Blair, and you can't ignore someone who's capable of that.
Andrew, it does seem the people who don't like him just don't really get him, don't really understand what the appeal is.
Yeah, they're never going to like him, are they? Although there are some people, it comes sometimes as a sort of individual sort of epiphany or something, the sort of scales fall from their eyes and they suddenly think, gosh, Boris could be Prime Minister. And it always seems that it's a sort of individual discovery. They suddenly say this occasion, or some, from time to time they say it to me, and they have really sort of worked it out for themselves. But you're right, there is also a sort of Cromwellian element in British politics and British political commentary, and these Puritans are always going to find Boris an utterly scandalous, rackety, disreputable, untrustworthy figure who oughtn't even to be Mayor of London and certainly shouldn't get any further. But of course, the joy for the sort of the rest of us is that these people get so angry that it's actually, it sort of adds to the general.
It's interesting that one of the critics of Boris on the programme the other night was Conrad Black.
Oh, yes.
Another was Max Hastings. I mean, neither of them are saints, you know.
And Conrad, I mean, Boris very astutely praised Conrad. He gets credit for sort of magnanimity and for not just saying, well, this man went to prison, so why listen to a word he says?
But you've run the rule over him. Can he actually do the job? Because isn't that the worry that people have? And isn't that what people will take from that interview, that asked a few pointed questions, asked to react, he wasn't able to?
Well, hang on. I think he could manage as well as most politicians do when asked that.
But he was a shambles sort of at the dispatch
The question of whether he can do the job is, of course he can't, but he can employ people to do it for him.
There's also a big question.
Which is how he runs City Hall. I mean,
and also, if he becomes leader, it would almost certainly first be his leader of the opposition, not as Prime Minister, because it would happen. And then he'd have to do a much tougher job than Prime Minister in a way, which is being leader of the opposition, joyless task, divided party. Could he do that job before he then got to grandstand as a sort of neo-Roman emperor as Prime Minister?
And would he grow into it? Because the criticism you hear if you talk to people at City Hall is that Boris now is the same Boris that got elected three years ago.
I think that's an illusion, actually. I think to begin with, he kept on the most able people who Ken had employed, because he knew you couldn't sort of reinvent. If you had a sort of debathification, then nothing would work. But after he got elected for the second time, he did get rid of some people who he really didn't want to have around any longer. And he's got much more of his own people. And I think it is actually, ideological probably isn't quite the word, but there's a harsher edge to it, I think. And Eddie Lister's a pretty formidable character who has gathered a great deal of power into his own hands. So I think there has been a development at City Hall, and he's got this man in to advise him about the economy. It's becoming more of a sort of, you know.
So the question here then is can you have a Prime Minister who delegates quite so much?
Because that's
clearly his modus operandi, though.
Well, yes, except that Simon Milton, who ran it for him for about 3 years before dying at a very early age, but who absolutely understood how London local government worked in a technical fashion and would read the papers about some terrible planning decision, he, I think, enjoyed working for Boris because you could explain the thing in 3 seconds to Boris. It wasn't like propping up some Bertie Wooster figure who simply didn't have the intellectual capacity to take it in. When Boris, I mean, he couldn't have learnt Latin and Greek if he didn't have a good memory. He has an amazing memory. And if he ever claims that he can't remember something, take that with a pinch of salt.
I've heard the very much the same thing, actually, that what everyone likes about Boris in City Hall is that you only have to brief him once. Also, that when he cares and he wants to do something, his capability with detail and as an executive authority is quite impressive. So everyone dealing with the Olympics, as soon as Boris realised what the Olympics could mean for him and for London, he was across it in a very effective executive way.
Oh, that's really interesting. So at the end of the week, you've got half the people thinking he's a sap and half the people thinking he's a genius, which means that we're not really much further forward.
I'm not sure it's half and half. I think you may have got the proportions a bit wrong.
Maybe so. Okay, looking wider afield, Benedict Brogan, the politics sage at the soon-to-be paywall Telegraph, wrote this week that the Tories are already on a post-Cameron footing. Of course, this does dovetail with our discussion of Boris. Is that the sense you're getting, Toby?
Yes, I think they are. But I think it's kind of worse than that, in that I think that they are such a disparate group, the Tories now, that there is no coherence in what they're doing. They're not moving forward as a group. They're moving forward. Well, they're not moving forward. They're simply disunited. And so you get different factions thinking about different solutions. But the different factions are thinking about different solutions which are not David Cameron. And the Cameronistas are a pretty small group, and that's for many, many reasons to do with the coalition, to do with the fact that he's overlooked a lot of people, to do with the fact that he's not a very good communicator with his backbenchers, to do with the fact that he hasn't offered leadership on many issues. But yes, I would agree with the broad conclusion, yeah.
Andrew, is he too far gone, or is there anything he can now do?
I think Brogan's piece was an absolutely accurate account of the present state of opinion in the Tory party, but I wouldn't underestimate David Cameron. I think he's often, I mean, who knows what will happen. This is still a mid-term sort of slump, which actually could well have been deeper, and perhaps should have been deeper. They maybe should have taken more decisive grip of the deficit and things, but I think Cameron he's just as competitive as Boris in a different sort of insidery establishment style. He's a very good, he's at his best when he's sort of, you know, up against it and is forced to take some risks. And he's very self-possessed. So I wouldn't write him off, actually. And he's good at using the position of prime minister to sort of, although he, of course, his sort of Achilles heel is he didn't actually win a majority. But nevertheless, he is good at using what authority he has as prime minister to impose himself on situations.
Raphael, last word to you. Is that what he's got to do? Wait for an event and grab it?
I think he's really running out of time quite badly now, actually. I spoke to an embittered minister very recently who described Cameron's leadership as redeemable, but that as long as he gets rid of George Osborne, you know, so the kind of conversations that are going on are so deep into
Night of the Wrong Night.
Yeah, butchery, treachery. Ultimately, I mean, I remember the Labour are very weak in all sorts of ways. I remember talking to people in the Conservative Party months ago saying, you know, actually all you guys need is a period of sustained, competent government to expose the divisions in Labour and the economy to pick up a little bit, tiny bit. And you'd be home and dry, possibly. And they would say, that's absolutely right, that's all we've got to do. And they can't do it. They simply can't do it.
Sounds a great time of great intrigue in the Commons and a great time to be there. But that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Andrew Jimson, Toby Helm and Raphael Baer. The producer of our podcast was Phil Maynard. I'm Hugh Muir. Bye from us and goodbye from David Miliband, the man who was nicknamed Brains, now the head of International Rescue. There's a joke there somewhere.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.